Dan Shelley is Executive Director of the Radio Television Digital News Association, or RTDNA, and its foundation. You were named incoming Executive Director in April and formally took over the post this week. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Your name and voice might sound familiar to our listeners as you began your career in Springfield and worked at KTTS for a while.
I worked at KTTS. I got my job there while I was a student at MSU, and first as an intern, and then during my internship, they had to kick me out of the building every night because I loved it so much. I was always hanging around and always asking to do assignments, and that led to a job there. And 3 years later, I became news director and was news director for 12 more years before I moved on.
And we, of course, would be remiss if we didn't say you'd had a position and a role to play here at KSMU.
Yeah, I came through KSMU and had a lot of classes in the building, and did a brief radio feature for the president's office for a time.
Tell us about the role of RTDNA, who it represents, and your responsibilities as executive director.
Well, RTDNA was founded in 1946 by a radio news director. It was originally the Radio News Editors Association, then became the Radio News Directors Association. Then in the 50s, it became the Radio Television News Directors Association. And then in the early 2000s, we changed our name to the Radio Television Digital News Association to reflect the changes in the landscape. We're the world's largest professional association devoted exclusively to broadcast and digital journalism. We advocate on behalf of the First Amendment and press freedom. We also provide continuing education and professional development for our members and others in the industry. And we honor what I call outstanding responsible journalism through our Edward R. Murrow Awards, of which KSMU has been a multiple recipient, I'm proud to say. So it's a very interesting time to be an advocate for press freedom and the First Amendment in particular.
Yeah, you did start a new task force called the Voice of the First Amendment Task Force. Tell us what that entails.
We started it early this year. As you know, the level of rhetoric, anti-news media rhetoric, and there's always been a segment of the population that at best has had tepid support for the news media. But that sentiment really started to escalate during the 2016 presidential election cycle. And we formed the task force early this year because this phenomenon of the most dishonest people in the room from one of the major presidential candidates, these people are disgusting, the fake news, the enemy of the American people rhetoric. Originally, that targeted only the national news media, but particularly since Inauguration Day here in 2017, that started to filter down to the local level. And we're hearing from members and other local news organizations all across the country that they are seeing a significant increase in the amount of obstruction that they're seeing as they try to perform their constitutionally guaranteed duty to seek and report the truth. Obstruction, threats, harassment, arrests, and assaults. Most people don't realize, but since the first of the year, at least 20 journalists have been arrested across the country just for doing their jobs, just for asking the questions, just for photographically or through video documenting news events. At least 16 journalists, many of them local journalists, have been assaulted by members of the public and by protesters and counter-protesters, six of those 16 in Charlottesville, Virginia. In late August in Berkeley, California, there was supposed to be an alt-right demonstration, and calmer heads prevailed because the city convinced the alt-right demonstrators to cancel their demonstration in light of what happened in Charlottesville. But the counter-protesters, the anarchists, Antifa and other groups, didn't hear about the cancellation, so they showed up anyway. And when there were no alt-right protesters to go after, they started attacking reporters and other people who were just there documenting, taking photos and videos with their phones. They beat people. They stomped on their cameras. Don't take pictures of us. So it's a nonpartisan phenomenon, if you will. It's coming at journalists from all points along the political and ideological spectrum.
Besides safety, which is an obvious threat there for journalists. What is their biggest concern when it comes to being able to freely report on these events?
Well, that's why we're here to help. We meaning RTDNA. I mean, we offer coverage guidelines, and we have a code of ethics that helps guide broadcast and digital journalists as they perform their duties every day. We also offer legal services. We have on retainer a very high-powered First Amendment attorney in Washington, whom we make available to local counsel for journalists who might be arrested or get sued to help those local counsel form their arguments and their cases based on relevant Supreme Court case law. And we provide other support. If we hear from a journalist, hey, I'm in the middle of a hurricane and I've got no place to go, we try to find them a place to go.
I think this is a good time to just remind our audience what kinds of reporting should be able to be carried out based on a reporter's First Amendment rights.
All kinds. The First Amendment isn't just about freedom of press. It's about freedom of speech, freedom of peaceable assembly, freedom of religious expression, and freedom to petition the government for redress of grievances. We defend all of the First Amendment, not just the part of the First Amendment that deals with freedom of the press, though that's our predominant focus. It has been decided time and time again in the highest court in our land, the U.S. Supreme Court, that the First Amendment protects journalists from government interference, from government obstruction, reporters who are in the field every day trying to fulfill their constitutionally guaranteed duty to seek and report the truth know they have that on their side, but it doesn't always help because you never know when you're going to encounter that police officer who isn't familiar with what journalists' rights are. One of the 20 reporters and journalists who've been arrested so far this year was a photojournalist in Las Vegas who was arrested for standing on a public sidewalk, what he thought was a public sidewalk, just taking video of an anti-Donald Trump protest outside his Las Vegas property. He'd been there dozens of times before doing exactly the same thing from exactly the same spot, but for some reason that day the police decided he couldn't be there and they arrested him and took him to jail. There was also a case in May in West Virginia, Charleston, West Virginia, where a reporter for Public News Service named Dan Hyman was arrested walking in the public hallway of the public state capital of West Virginia simply for trying to ask a question of Health and Human Services Secretary Tom Price. Now, thank God, just last week, the charges were dropped against him. He was charged with interfering with a governmental process simply for asking questions, doing his job. In Southwest Florida, this isn't an arrest, but it's another indicator of the kinds of things that are going on now in America. In Fort Myers, Florida, way pre-Irma, a local television station did an investigative report on the looking into the highly unusual large number of unsolved murder cases in Fort Myers, Florida. They based their report on a U.S. Department of Justice report that said one of a number of factors contributing to the large number of unsolved murders in Fort Myers, Florida, was the prosecutorial philosophy of the local prosecuting attorney. They interviewed the prosecutor. He explained that it was his philosophy that unless he was 100% sure he would get a conviction, he would not take a murder case to trial. So he had the chance to explain his philosophy. They also talked to community leaders who were critical of that policy. It was a very fair and balanced story, and not in the Fox News Roger Ailes sense. It was really fair and balanced. And then the prosecutor sued the TV station for defamation. And in the legal papers, the petition in which he laid out the reasons for his lawsuit, he said he decided to sue because the report left him with, and this is a quote, with hurt feelings. So we made our First Amendment attorney in D.C. available to the local counsel of that TV station to help them form the right arguments to counter that defamation suit. I mean, can you imagine a few years ago a local prosecutor suing a local TV station because a report hurt his or her feelings? No, but it's happening. Things like that are happening all over the country today.
And of course, RTDNA making the resources available after the fact if those events do present themselves. What can be done to mitigate those types of situations?
Well, our Voice of the First Amendment Task Force has two missions. The first mission is to defend against every attack on the First Amendment and press freedom. The second mission is to work with journalists to help them learn how to be more transparent in their reporting so that they can help the public better understand why outstanding responsible journalism is essential to their daily lives. All over the country, every single day, there are reports that come out in local TV, local radio, on local digital news outlets that expose a problem or expose corruption or shine light on a situation that otherwise the public wouldn't have known about. And those stories serve as catalysts that lead to positive change in those communities. And we've got to do a better job as journalists in highlighting those situations, in explaining to the public the ethical dilemmas that we face every single day and how we resolve those ethical dilemmas to try to be responsible and to try to be members of the community. I mean, journalists who work all across America and here in Springfield are not just journalists. They're your neighbors. They're, in many cases, your friends. Their kids go to the same school your kids go to. They're part of the community. And I think we saw recently in Hurricane Harvey in particular, journalists risked their own lives and their own safety, not only to save lives by keeping the public informed, but in a few cases, literally saving lives, jumping into the raging floodwaters and pulling people out of their cars that were being swept away and their trucks. And in one case, a local TV reporter in Houston helped a woman in the middle of the raging floodwaters deliver her newborn son. Now, that's the kind of thing journalists do. David Begno, who's a correspondent for CBS News, who in fact rescued someone from the flooding in Harvey, when he was interviewed by the Associated Press for a story on reporters in Harvey, he said, "Look, I'm a journalist, but I'm a human being too." And that I'm so proud, not just of David Begno for saying that, but of all the journalists in Harvey and most recently in Irma, and all the journalists who are working hard every single day just to make sure that they're doing their part to help create an informed and educated society.
You mentioned fake news earlier. Wanted to talk more about that. How is intentional fake news or the accusation of news being fake impacting journalism?
Well, there are two types of fake news. The first kind is intentionally, deliberately reported false information designed to further a certain agenda or to battle an opposing agenda. Then there is news that is labeled as fake news only because the subject of that story or stories either doesn't like, doesn't appreciate, or that truthful information runs counter or is inconvenient to whatever their agenda might be. So the difference, and it's a very stark, clear difference between the two kinds of fake news. When responsible journalists make mistakes, and they do because they're human beings, we are human beings, all human beings make mistakes, we take responsibility for those mistakes. We correct them quickly. We correct them with the same prominence in which they're made. Often we're held accountable. Some have lost jobs for neglect or careless reporting. So we are held accountable, responsible journalists, when we make mistakes. When the purveyors of real fake news, the intentional false information, the intentional dissemination of false information, when they're called out on their mistakes, they double down on the information, and they don't apologize, and they don't allow themselves to be held accountable. And that's what the public needs to understand, and we need to do a better job of helping them understand. The other thing is too many people in America, and this is our fault as journalists. I'm not blaming the public for this, but too many people in America conflate the opinion media with real journalism. They don't understand that, the Sean Hannity program on Fox News or Fox and Friends on Fox News, those are opinion shows. But there, in between those shows, there's real journalism occurring. On MSNBC, on the other side of the political spectrum, they'll see Rachel Maddow or Chris Matthews, Chris Hayes, Lawrence O'Donnell, and they'll think that's the news. It's not the news. Those are opinions and interpretations of the news to further those hosts' opinion. In the meantime, during the day on MSNBC, you've got real journalism occurring. So we need to help the public understand there's a difference between opinion media and responsible journalism.
And those two elements of fake news, again, the deliberate fake news and then the stories that are portrayed as fake, do you see that continuing to be an ongoing issue, or is that something RTDNA can step in and help educate and ultimately kind of push back against?
Well, we are pushing back against it, and we are helping local newsrooms across the country develop ways to build trust with their communities and their audiences. We're working with the National Association of Broadcasters, for example. We provided them with a one sheet of tips for TV and radio general managers to help them help their newsrooms build trust in the community. And one of the things that we suggest and the NAB is suggesting based on the one sheet we provided them is that more TV and radio local general managers go on the air themselves and do editorials or commentaries in which they explain their station's news philosophy. They explain particular sensitive stories and how decisions were made as to how those stories were reported and why. And that's just one example, but there are many things that journalists can and should be doing at the local level to help the public understand that, these are my neighbors. These are people in my community. I understand now why they didn't report the name of so-and-so. So we have to do a much better job in that regard.
How would you assess the level of trust that consumers have in journalism today?
I would say it's tepid at best, but there is a ray of hope for local journalists. Studies and surveys and polls consistently show that while overall trust for the news media is tepid, as I said, local news organizations are trusted more than national news organizations. They're trusted more than social media, and they're trusted more than what people hear from their own friends and family. I mean, that's scientific research. That's empirical data. That's not just something I'm making up. That's not fake news. It's the truth. So the ray of hope here is that working with local journalists across the country, we can build on the trust that they already enjoy from the public and make it even stronger. And we hope that will permeate all across the country. I almost hate to use this expression, but it's true. The news media is like Congress. Everybody says they hate Congress in the abstract, but they sure love their local congressman. People say they hate the news media in the abstract, but boy, I sure like that John Smith who is on Channel 7 at 6 o'clock giving me the news.
It's no secret there's a great political divide in D.C. and among citizens on the left and right. Media reports on this every day. Based on these reports, I'm curious how you would assess the level of civility in our nation at this time.
Well, all things come from the top, right? And while RTDNA is a nonpartisan organization, we have criticized the Obama and Clinton administrations, particularly the Obama administration, for promising to be the most transparent in history, and it turned out to be just the opposite. During the Trump administration, I think the level of rhetoric and the increasing vitriol that we've heard from our highest elected official in the land and his supporters, and that we will hear more of from local congressional candidates who have already been advised by their consultants to follow the attack the media model that the president used so successfully to fire up his base. So we're concerned, and local media organizations that we've spoken with all across the country are concerned about this civility problem because it has a real impact, a discernible, tangible impact on journalists' ability to do their jobs, but it's also creating just more divided thought and less less productive debate about very serious and important issues that have to occur. You know, to bring it back to journalism for just a second, I saw a photograph the other day that was taken at a pro-Trump rally, and it was a man wearing a T-shirt, and on the back of his T-shirt, it said, "Tree, rope, journalist, some assembly required." And this was just a guy attending a Trump rally. I don't blame the president for that T-shirt, but I blame the president for the vitriol and the attacks, nearly constant at times, on the kinds of responsible journalism that he just doesn't like or finds inconvenient. And a lack of civility can have consequences. And we're seeing those consequences on the streets of virtually every community in America every single day. And it's too bad.
Does the media have a role in being a voice for civil discourse?
We have to be the proverbial calm in the storm. We have to, the only antidote to attacks on journalism is more and better journalism. And by more and better journalism, I mean crossing every T, dotting every I, making sure every fact is correct, and being, as I said, the calm in the storm, and not losing our cool. Because as our detractors attack us, even, you know, the people wearing the some assembly required T-shirts about journalists, hanging journalists from trees, lynching journalists, we can't get into the gutter with those people as journalists. We have to continue to do our jobs. We have to persevere, and we have to do it with a calm, level head.
If we didn't address some of those already, are there some other goals that you in this executive director position now will be working towards with RTDNA?
Sure. We have continuing education, professional development programming for our members and others. I want to increase that kind of training, the amount of training that we're doing for journalists, everything from anchor training to how to responsibly report on climate change, which is a huge issue that doesn't get enough attention, in my personal opinion. We need to do more training about ethics and covering guidelines. Most recently in Hurricane Irma, I believe it's because it came so fast on the heels of Hurricane Harvey, a lot of TV reporters have taken a hit, not physical hit, but taken criticism for standing out in the storm. Some critics have said, well, why do you have to stand in all that wind and rain and blowing sand? Are you doing it for ratings? Are you doing it for awards? Are you doing it for thrill seeking? I mean, what's going on? And what people don't realize is that, A, hurricanes are a very visual story. B, by being out in the storm and showing what it's doing to people, reporters, that serves as a call to the public, stay indoors. Don't come out in this. You see what's happening to us. And it also serves a very important function to make sure that the public knows where the shelters are, when their power's coming back on. If you didn't evacuate, get at least 15 feet above sea level because the storm surge is going to be 12 to 14 feet. So those reporters play a vital role. And what most people don't understand, the critics, they don't understand that almost all of those reporters, I can't unequivocally state that every single one of them, but all those reporters who stand out in the wind in the hurricane, they have safety measures in place. They have a shelter just off camera that you don't see, that if they ever felt like, okay, I'm really in danger, they run to this shelter, place of shelter where they know that they will be safe. Some wear Kevlar vests, some wear helmets, some wear safety glasses. So they're more protected than you think. It's interesting in reading a response to this criticism of the journalists of Irma, an unnamed network executive said, it's because the New York Times did a big piece, and other what I call capital J journalists did a did a lot of stories criticizing the TV reporters for how they covered Irma. And one of the stories quoted an unnamed network executive saying, "While the Times has a lot of chutzpah for going after TV news for being in hurricanes, when they embed their reporters in war zones, it's the same principle, you know. So we want to speak out about issues like that and help explain to the public why those TV reporters are out in the storm instead of tucked away safely in a newsroom in a faraway city somewhere.
Anything else we didn't cover you'd like to share with our audience?
Well, I hope people, I hope your listeners, and I hope the people of my hometown and my home region of the Ozarks, even if they hold an opinion or a view that the media are biased, and I've heard that throughout my entire career, that's nothing new. By the way, the term fake news isn't new either. It originated 80 years ago with some conservative radio talk show hosts in the 1930s. So even folks in my home area, the Ozarks, where I came from and still love to visit, even if they believe that the media are biased or the media are engaged in fake news or the media are the enemy of the American people, I would hope that they would at least have enough of an open mind to listen to our side of that debate and to give it some consideration. And to understand that when the reporters here in Springfield and other communities of the Ozarks, when they're out asking questions and holding the powerful accountable, that they're doing that on the public's behalf. Because every time a journalist is harassed, obstructed, threatened, assaulted, or arrested, the reporter isn't the victim. The public is the victim because it's not able to get the information it needs to make wise decisions about the future of their family's life and their communities.
Dan Shelley, the executive director of RTDNA, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. My pleasure.